The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Big uncertainty in the Caribbean about the stability and future of Haiti and Cuba. In Cuba, the government is clamping down hard on protesters.
There were long lines full of mothers and wives asking to know the whereabouts of their loved ones.
Also today, questions about the need for a third vaccination for the coronavirus. Many argue that a booster shot doesn't make sense right now.
The pandemic is not going to go away just by vaccinating the rich.
I'm Marco Werman, and Tedros Ghebreyesus, he broke barriers at the World Health Organization.
There is the level of connection and the level of excitement knowing that he's the first African WHO DG.
But a second term as a director general could be a referendum on his job during the pandemic. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. Two major geopolitical events in the Caribbean, Haiti and Cuba, both in upheaval. In a moment, we'll get to Haiti. First to Cuba, where the government is worried that a spark could become a fire. Pro-democracy protests on the island appear to be the biggest anti-government demonstrations there in three decades. Cuban activists say more than 100 people have been arrested or are missing since protests began over the weekend. Details are scarce. The internet is down. But old-fashioned phone calls still get through.
Hello?
Artist Tanya Bruguera lives in Havana. She's been arrested numerous times for her activism. Tanya, activists like you have been encouraging visible creative dissent for many years in Cuba. What turned Cubans out into the streets this weekend?
The people have been seeing their houses crumbling while they're seeing luxury hotels being built all around the country. People had enough of the disparity between classes, the political class that has everything and is completely exempt of everything, and the government is not taking any responsibility.
Are the protests still going on?
They are. The 11th of July, there were thousands of people, tens of thousands of people around the whole island in a spontaneous outbreak, which is something that is now being challenged by the government. Now they are saying that this is a campaign, it's paid by the U.S., etc. I tell you, I know a lot of the dissidents, a lot of the opposition groups. There is no dissident group at all that has the capability to do what happened. This happened because people said they are not afraid anymore. So yesterday also there were people still on the street in different areas, and there were long lines full of mothers and wives of the people who were detained asking to know the whereabouts of their loved ones.
Also, we saw protesters overturning a police car, looting a government-run store this weekend. That seems really rare in Cuba.
It is unusual, but the narrative of the government is to blame once again the people for the hunger they're suffering.
Well, Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, has been defiant, saying about the protesters they'll have to walk over our dead bodies if they want to take on the revolution. But isn't he also acknowledging just how severe the economic problems are in Cuba?
Well, I'm telling you something. I talked to several of the activists we work with, and all of them told me that the amount of people defending the revolution was significantly smaller than the people who were protesting. They were the minority.
I'm speaking with Cuban activist and artist Tanya Bruguera. She's in Havana. So how have authorities reacted to the protests over the weekend, the protests that are still going on?
They cut the internet to the whole country. Some of the activists that we were able to take out of the prison yesterday told us there were hundreds of young people inside the jail. some of them underage people, without access to a phone call, without internet access. Of course, nobody has internet. So you have a situation where on top of everything, you have parents who are desperate, looking for their kids in police stations without knowing where their kids are. The list of missing people is more than 1,000.
Wow. Tanya, what is your own situation? Are you being watched? Have you been protesting?
Well, I have 2 police patrols downstairs permanently, 24/7.
And that was before these protests started, those police patrols at your house?
Before these protests, I only had 1. Now I have 2 police patrols. But I'm not worried. I'm not worried.
Why are you not worried? That seems like a really desperate situation.
You know, I'm not worried because, to be honest, after so many years asking for freedom of expression and for the law to be fair and equal for everyone, I think it's fine if I have to sacrifice.
How many people are there like you in Cuba right now?
I think right now in Cuba, many people are in the same position. Many people are thinking alike. The time has come to stop thinking about us and start thinking about the good of all.
Where do you see these protests going? Do you see them increasing in size?
I don't know what is going to happen when the internet is restored and people see, for example, I have not seen any image. I heard people calling me from abroad, telling me what they have seen, but I have not seen anything. And who knows, maybe once the internet is restored, people see this and get outraged again.
So I just want to clarify that. The internet is down. You have not left your apartment. The pictures that we're seeing in the United States, all across the world, of what happened last weekend in Cuba, essentially nobody in Cuba has seen yet. Is that right?
Exactly.
Tanya Bruguera is a Cuban artist and activist. She's been speaking with us from Havana. Thank you very much for your time, Tanya.
Thank you very much for looking to what's happening in Cuba now.
Now to the other current Caribbean political hotspot, Haiti, and the investigation into the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse gets more complex each day. The plot is a puzzle that stretches across the region, including a doctor from Florida and former members of the Colombian military. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has the latest.
Investigators in Haiti have numerous suspects in custody, but they haven't said exactly who ordered the assassination and why.
Yes, you did.
Haiti's National Police Commissioner, Léon Char, gave a statement in Port-au-Prince on Sunday.
Monsieur Char, il est connu sous le nom de Christian Emmanuel Sano.
Char said officers have arrested a 63-year-old Haitian doctor who lives in Florida named Christian Emmanuel Sano.
C'est un individu qui était entré en Haïti à bord d'un avion privé avec des objectifs politiques.
Char says Sanon flew to Haiti last month aboard a private plane and with political objectives in mind. He says Sanon recruited the gunman who murdered President Moïse, and that Sanon had worked with a Florida-based security company called CTU to hire retired members of the Colombian military.
Avec une délégation de plus haut niveau du gouvernement de la Colombie.
Char says Haitian police have been working with the help of Colombian intelligence officials who've traveled to Haiti.
Muy buenos días para todos.
Colombian Police General Jorge Luis Vargas gave public statements from Bogotá yesterday.
Hemos logrado la identificación de 21 colombianos. 21 colombianos.
Vargas confirmed at least 21 Colombian men are connected to the murder of President Moïse. 3 of them were killed and 18 were arrested.
19 tiquetes aéreos.
Vargas says someone with a credit card from the security company in Florida, CTU, bought plane tickets for 19 of the men. They flew from Bogotá to Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic, which borders Haiti. Vargas also said that the Colombian police are looking into the recent travel itinerary of President Moïse's head of security.
Tuvimos conocimiento que el comisario Dimitri Gerard, jefe de la unidad de seguridad, jefe de la unidad de seguridad general del Palacio Nacional de Haití.
Vargas says Dimitri Erard used Colombia as a transit point this year to travel between the Dominican Republic, Panama, and Ecuador. He says Colombian investigators are looking into what Erard may have done while he was in Colombian territory. Meanwhile, family members of the retired Colombian soldiers say they're trying to make sense of the situation. Giovanna Romero is wife of the former First Sergeant Mauricio Javier Romero, who was killed last week. Romero says her husband told her he was working as a type of bodyguard for a very important person. She spoke in an interview with Bogotá's W Radio. She says her husband got recruited last month by another Colombian soldier to travel to the Dominican Republic and then to Haiti. Romero says she regularly spoke to her husband over a video call. Sometimes she'd see him in what appeared to be his room, and he told her that he was sharing cooking duties with other bodyguards. This is an otherwise unremarkable occurrence, says Raúl Muset, director of the Colombian Association of Soldiers and Marine Professionals. It's very common for retired Colombian soldiers to get recruited by foreign security companies, Muset says. Over the past 10 years, many have gone to provide services around the world. Muset says this is because Colombia has been at war for almost 60 years, and special forces soldiers are well prepared for private security after retirement. But the assassination of Haiti's president has governments throughout the region alarmed. Haitian police are getting help from Interpol, the FBI, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Do we now need another shot for COVID-19, a third shot, a booster? Israel says yes, it's giving boosters to high-risk people. Some countries and vaccine producers are also preparing for another shot. Mike Ryan at the World Health Organization slammed the idea yesterday.
This is people who want to have their cake and eat it. Then they make some more cake and they want to eat that as well.
In other words, with much of the world population still waiting for their first shot, now Ryan believes is not the time to be talking about adding a third one with limited global supplies. Joining me to unpack all this now is Dr. Kausar Talat. She's a global health professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And a disclosure, she will be involved in an upcoming trial of Pfizer's booster shot in the United States. Dr. Talat, first of all, we're seeing places like Israel move forward with boosters. U.S. officials say it's not necessary right now. Why the confusion in this moment?
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking to and what you're looking at. Now, what Israel's doing is vaccinating people who are particularly vulnerable because their immune systems are weaker, because they're immunocompromised, because they're transplant patients. And I think that we are still investigating this, and there's trials that are coming out every day looking at the immune response in people who are immunocompromised for some reason. But I think it's premature to recommend boosters widely.
Premature.
Yes, absolutely. For most people, boosters aren't necessary.
So as to that question, how long do the current vaccines last? WHO scientists say boosters may be needed down the line, but so far there's no evidence to support that.
Yes.
So what is the range of longevity of these vaccines once you get them?
Well, we don't know. You know, the longest anybody's had a COVID vaccine has been since March of 2020. Mm. And so we're still learning about them, but it's not just the antibody responses that we need to be measuring. We also need to look at breakthrough infections and severe disease. And so far, we're not seeing an increase in severe disease hospitalizations among people who are vaccinated. We're seeing severe disease and hospitalizations among the unvaccinated people. And those are the people we should be targeting for vaccines.
So apparently four countries have announced booster programs. A few more are thinking about it. That would mean using limited materials to make millions of shots while much of the world, even frontline healthcare workers, are still without vaccines. I mean, I hear the voice of Mike Ryan from earlier and his warning about wheeling out a third shot when there are so many inequities globally. What is the trade-off scientifically and ethically to boosters versus getting more first shots in arms in like Africa, Latin America, and other parts of the world?
High-income countries right now have the bulk of the vaccines, and the majority of people who are vaccinated so far are people in high-income or high-middle-income countries. But the pandemic is not going to go away just by vaccinating the rich. And just from a let's make the pandemic go away, much less an equity perspective, we need to vaccinate as many people as possible everywhere, or else we'll continue to have the virus circulating, we'll continue to have variants developing, and potentially a variant that will escape the vaccine and make it not work for anybody. So we need to use our scarce resources to vaccinate as many people as possible in as many places as possible all over the world.
Dr. Kausar Talat is a vaccine researcher at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marco. It's a pleasure.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The reaction to the murder of George Floyd last year was global. At the United Nations Human Rights Council, a group of African countries had called for an independent inquiry into police brutality. Today, after more than a year, the council approved a resolution to establish such a panel. The representative from Cameroon spoke earlier today.
This resolution effectively operationalized the call towards transformative change of racial justice and equality.
The resolution explicitly acknowledges the legacy of colonialism and the impact of the slave trade on present-day racial injustices. The representative from China also spoke in favor of today's resolution. He said it will provide an opportunity for countries to assume responsibility for their historic crimes.
And not let tragedies of George Floyd and the numerous other victims of racism repeat themselves.
The small panel of experts in law and human rights will be given 3 years to complete their work. Their mandate, to investigate law enforcement, make recommendations, then follow up to see what's actually been implemented. The panel will also look at government responses to peaceful anti-racism protests. There was some pushback today. The representative from Austria, speaking for the European Union, questioned the need for a new body.
Negotiations on this draft resolution were not easy. Discussions on this subject often bring a lot of emotions. This time was no different.
There's another sticking point to all of this, the question of reparations. Earlier this month, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights recommended this possibility. The representative from the UK spoke about that today.
The proposals for reparations for colonialism and slavery divert focus from the pressing challenges of tackling contemporary racism and global inequality.
Despite the arguments, when it came time to vote today, the resolution establishing an independent panel passed without opposition. Lawmakers in the UK are dealing with a question that is vexing them, one that may surprise you. Do lobsters feel pain? The British Parliament is considering whether invertebrates like lobsters and crabs should be classified as sentient beings. If lobsters are added to Britain's new animal welfare sentience laws, it would mean boiling lobsters alive could be banned. From London, the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Nigel Bloxham runs the Crab House Cafe at the famous Chesil Beach in southwest England, where they only sell fish that's locally caught.
We sell crabs and lobsters and other shellfish such as mussels, oysters, clams. We sell any fish that swims past us, either in the lagoon or in the channel.
Bloxham has been cooking up all kinds of seafood for years. When he started out, he says, he always boiled lobsters alive.
Yeah. It was the way the books told us to do it, you know. It was the way we were shown to do it back along, you know.
And that's how he cooked crabs too.
If you put a crab into boiling water, it will shoot all its legs. It's trying to escape, you know, it will throw its legs off its body.
It's descriptions like these that are upsetting some British lawmakers. They're currently deciding on the terms of the UK's new Animal Welfare Sentience Bill. But what does sentient actually mean?
In general terms, what it means is that a creature is capable of experiencing pain and pleasure.
Maisie Tomlinson lobbies for the humane treatment of crustaceans with a group called Crustacean Compassion.
You know, you wouldn't expect to be able to buy a live rabbit from a butcher's and then store it in your fridge for several days and then kill it by boiling it alive. There would be an absolute outcry. So really, we're talking about relatively small tweaks, particularly at the fishing end of things.
Tomlinson is thrilled at the way the debate is going in the UK. Because of Brexit, Britain is no longer subject to the European Union's animal welfare standards and is now drawing up its own laws. The Animal Welfare Sentience Bill is making its way through Parliament and it's fired up lawmakers like Baroness Janet Fuchs.
I have been shocked by some of the treatment of animals such as lobsters, crabs, squid and so on, by the way they have been stored and very often killed. There was one horrible example of a supermarket tightly wrapping a crab, a live crab, in one-use plastic, a double abomination as far as I'm concerned.
Fellow peers also cited the Oscar-winning film My Octopus Teacher as proof that even mollusks have feelings. The documentary follows the unusual relationship between filmmaker Craig Foster and an octopus.
You can compare her intelligence to a cat or a dog or even to one of the lower primates. A mollusk shouldn't be this intelligent.
There are scientific studies that suggest lobsters do feel pain, but not all scientists are so sure. Robert Stenick has been studying lobsters in the waters off the coast of Maine for almost 30 years.
I don't know exactly how one differentiates between reacting to a stimulus and what we think of as pain. You know, my sense has always been that for organisms with higher cognitive capacity, you feel pain so that you can learn and remember and avoid it in the future. Lobster's ability to learn is modest, but it's not zero. And so I really don't know.
Stenick is professor of marine sciences at the University of Maine. He says he often wonders why other shellfish are barely mentioned in these debates.
A lot of people don't think anything of boiling clams or eating oysters, even eating oysters raw, because they share so few characters that are identifiable to humans. Whereas something that has eyes and it has claws that some people might think of as hands, something that actually reacts by flipping their tail when they're in hot water, that's interpreted by humans as a painful end-of-life experience.
Some British lawmakers are inclined to agree. Lord Daniel Moylan says he worries that including invertebrates in the sentience bill is just going too far.
The clause that strikes me as most extravagant is the one that gives the Secretary of State the unfettered power to declare, should he wish, that an earthworm is a sentient being. My lords, this is a power greater than that given by God to Adam in the Garden of Eden.
British anglers too say they're concerned about what the new law might mean for them and how it might infringe on their way of life. Crabhouse Cafe owner Nigel Bloxham says he hasn't made up his mind about the bill just yet.
I don't know. I think I'm in favour of it. I mean, yes, I can see that if we're killing for food, we ought to think about doing it humanely anyway. You know, as humane as we can.
These days, Bloxham uses a device called a crustastun to kill the lobsters. It zaps them with an electric current. He says that knocks them out in under a second. But there's a catch. The crustastun retails at more than $3,000. The animal welfare bill still has a long way to go and is likely to go through many amendments before it's ever made into law. So it may be some time yet before British seafood chefs are forced to change their ways. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
For the second time in just 3 months, a deadly fire killed dozens at a COVID-19 isolation ward at a hospital in Iraq. Every morning, our newsletter reports top headlines like that hospital fire and delivers them to your email inbox. Sign up to get a preview of the stories we're following. Head over to theworld.org/newsletters. In Ghana, in West Africa, the vaccination drive is in full swing. Ghana's president was the first to get the jab. He's also trying to persuade others that vaccines are safe.
Taking the vaccine will not alter your DNA. It will not embed a tracking device in your body.
Ghana faces an uphill battle. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. South Africa is dealing with some of the worst unrest it's seen in years. Looters have ransacked shopping malls in two provinces, stealing food, liquor, and clothing. Dozens of people have been killed in chaotic stampedes. This follows the jailing of former South African President Jacob Zuma. Zuma was sentenced to 15 months in prison for defying a court order to testify in a corruption investigation. To get a better handle on the situation, William Gumede in Johannesburg joins us. He's the executive chairperson of the Democracy Works Foundation in South Africa. So, William, I said that this chaos follows the sentencing of former President Zuma, but is this unrest all about that, or is there more to it?
In the first instance, of course, you know, it was started by Jacob Zuma supporters who are trying to make the country ungovernable in a strategy to try to get clemency for Jacob Zuma, to try to get a presidential pardon. So, you know, that really is the big strategy. Right now, we've got extreme poverty in the country. We've just come out, being locked down, sort of cabin fever. People are coming out for the first time. And then also the economy crashed because of COVID-19. You know, we've got our biggest financial crisis in 100 years in South Africa because of COVID. And then there is also the inequality in South Africa.
Right, and this has all been festering for the past 30 years, since 94. How has the African National Congress, South Africa's ruling party, responded to this wave of violence? Are they doing anything to calm things down?
Unfortunately, you know, the ruling party has responded to it very inadequately. We haven't seen the president hasn't been visible. The ANC leadership haven't been visible. It's puzzling because, you know, we all know that when Jacob Zuma, when he was just about to go to jail, he refused initially for a long time, and he made threats, and his supporters made threats that they came to unleash violence. So one would have assumed that the government would be ready, would have been deployed, the army already then, deployed the police. The government haven't done that. You know, the ANC leaders did not want to be seen to come out hard on initially on Jacob Zuma supporters, because there's an election coming, a local government election coming in October, and these are the people that vote for the ANC. Perhaps more importantly, Jacob Zuma still has a lot of support within the ANC, within the ANC leadership, you know, where many of the ANC leaders are very reluctant to take on his supporters because they think his supporters are right to protest.
Yeah, it means that the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, is walking a fine line here. How do you think his government has handled the corruption trial of Zuma, the contempt of court charge, and then the 15-month sentence? Are the institutions, the political institutions in South Africa still intact, do you think?
I think what we've learned now is that our judiciary, South African judiciary and other democratic institutions, the press and civil society, are very strong. So clearly, I mean, the good thing is about our democracy, it is standing firm, is that when you come from an autocratic regime and you build a democracy, there are three things that you need to do as a country to entrench the democracy. The first is, you know, equality before the law. So that has now happened by the fact that Jacob Zuma has been sent to prison. It means no president is above the law. The second thing is the issue of rule of law. Now, unfortunately, we are struggling, as you can see now. People are looting Jacob Zuma supporters. They're getting away with it. So we have not established the rule of law. And then the last one is accountability, holding people accountable. I mean, we've held Jacob Zuma accountable by sending him to jail. Now we have to hold the looters accountable for destruction of property, of businesses, and of taking out, you know, ordinary citizens' lives.
I want to come back to the other thing that you were just talking about, economic inequality. I mean, it's obviously coming to a head after 27 years post-apartheid. One of the highest unemployment rates in the world, something like 43%, which has to be impacting young people especially. How has that changed the thinking among South Africa's youth about their hopes for the future?
You know, sadly, you know, that high unemployment level has meant that young people feel hopeless. They feel on the margins of the economy. And because of the lockdown, the COVID-19 lockdown, and, you know, many businesses have closed down, and it has increased the unemployment, it's very likely that the unemployment may be actually even be bigger than 40% among young people. Now, government has mismanaged our COVID-19 response. At the beginning, when other countries like Chile and Mexico and Costa Rica bought a whole ranges of vaccines, we didn't do that. And we started the slowest of any of our peer countries. So the government here only used the lockdown as an effort to deal with COVID-19. So the government actually mismanaged the COVID response, which has actually increased economic hardship for people. And of course, now this looting here that we've seen has now destroyed many, many businesses, and it will increase unemployment. And I don't think, you know, investors will be coming, whether local or international. You know, they'll see South Africa as a violent country, it's instable, the investments won't be stable, it won't be safe. So, you know, we've just, the looters and the Jacob Zuma crowds has just made it even more difficult from an economic perspective.
William, how do you see what's coming in the next days and weeks? What worries you the most?
What worries me is the lack of, we don't see the police, we don't see the army. Although the president yesterday made a statement that he's going to deploy the army, the reports that now I'm receiving and our foundation are receiving, because we are trying to see what we can do to help at a local level. The army is not there. You know, the police is overwhelmed, so they're very thinly stretched. And then the second thing is whether we will be able to get local mediators, religious leaders, local traditional leaders and local civil society groups, you know, to respond at a local level to help to bring peace, because the government on its own and the army on its own is not going to be able to do that. We'll have to have almost an all of society approach, the army and the police in the sort of hotspots, and then we have to have locals, local business leaders, you know, all have to come together and to try to stop the violence and the looting in their local areas.
William Gumede is the executive chairperson of the Democracy Works Foundation in South Africa, speaking with us from Johannesburg. William, thank you very much for explaining this.
Thank you.
If there is one voice on the global health stage that this past year has pushed into renown, it's this one.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening.
Tedros Ghebreyesus, director of the World Health Organization. 194 member states vote for the director general. Ghebreyesus' five-year term ends next summer, but according to Stat News, he reportedly plans to seek another term. As the world's Alana Gordon reports, it will be a referendum on how well he guided the globe through an incredibly challenging time.
Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus has been trying to guide the world through the biggest health crisis of the century.
It's not too late. I call on all countries to work together in solidarity.
I think this is important to recognize. It's an impossible job, but a really essential one.
Suri Moon co-directs the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute in Geneva.
WHO was born with a very ambitious mission, which was to be the directing and coordinating authority for international health matters, which is basically the boss of everything having to do with health worldwide.
Moon says the WHO director presides over a global health system and a Congress of member states, plus a disease control agency and logistics operation. The director general, or DG, sets standards, runs investigations, raises money, and steers the world through choppy political waters without any enforcement power. It's a lot. Ghebreyesus ran in 2016 for the DG seat against an initial pool of six candidates. He's from Ethiopia, where he was a longtime minister of health and then foreign minister.
I know war. I know poverty. I know disease.
Ghebreyesus often talks to the public about how his own upbringing drives his work. As a kid, he saw his younger brother die of an illness that could have been cured in a place with decent health care. When Tedros won, he became the first DG to be elected in a process where all member states had a vote. It was an especially big deal in Africa.
There is the level of connection and the level of excitement knowing that he is the first African WHO DG.
Dr. Githinji Gitahi is CEO of Amref Health, a large NGO based in Nairobi, Kenya. He says Ghebreyesus represented a hope that more would be done to improve health throughout the continent. And he says Ghebreyesus delivered.
And I remember him saying, all roads lead to universal health coverage. And I think pushing that agenda, and also the agenda that universal health coverage is not different from global health security, it had never been seen before.
In 2018, Ghebreyesus faced some pushback for the WHO's handling of Ebola.
As of June 2019, it's killed more than 1,400 people.
The outbreak in the DRC has taken years to contain.
There's also concern, though, that this virus could spread to neighboring Rwanda.
But really, Ghebreyesus's legacy all comes down to his handling of the pandemic. That's according to Thomas Boyke, director of global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says Ghebreyesus made some high-profile mistakes early on, and a recent independent assessment gave the WHO mixed reviews. The organization could have declared a pandemic sooner than it did.
Ultimately, the decision on declaring a public health emergency of international concern is his alone to make.
Also under the microscope is how Ghebreyesus responded to individual countries.
There will also be critiques that, as a general matter, moving throughout this pandemic, Dr. Tedros has been deferential to member states, including China. And some people, particularly in the United States, would have liked to see him be more aggressive in that regard.
Behind the scenes, Boyke says Ghebreyesus has given critical guidance and support to low and middle income countries. In general, DGs avoid confrontation with member states and work under the radar to coordinate. But Ghebreyesus stands out.
I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure.
He has charisma and is really politically savvy. Again, Suri Moon with the Graduate Institute.
I think you see it in COVID-19, the fact that Tedros is comfortable with foreign ministers and heads of state to a degree that health ministers are not often comfortable at that level of power.
Moon says that's important during a highly charged pandemic. His reviews have been positive. But now the world is entering a new phase. Infections are still raging. Moon says Ghebreyesus will need a solid vision on what needs to change to prevent future outbreaks. The question is, will he be able to bring people together, or will he alienate? Can meaningful progress be made?
What kinds of reforms can we make at the global level, given the world we're in today, highly fragmented, you know, rise of nationalist populism, anti-science backlash, ongoing COVID pandemic, in many parts of the world, it's going to be a huge, huge challenge.
How this unfolds in the weeks and months ahead will be a referendum not just on Ghebreyesus, but on the WHO itself and its future. Ghebreyesus's term ends next year. The deadline for member states to nominate candidates is this fall. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
The Biden administration just added more than a dozen additional Chinese companies to its economic blacklist. The U.S. Commerce Department says the companies are implicated in human rights abuses in China's northwest Xinjiang region. This follows another decision last month to ban the imports of certain Chinese products, also because of human rights concerns. The World's Anna Kusmer reports.
Those concerns are about Xinjiang and China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities there. Nirola Elema researches global supply chains, and when she looks through government documents and photos related to Xinjiang's vast labor program, she wonders if she'll see a face she knows, a cousin or a friend, because she grew up in that part of China.
So sometimes when I look at those pictures, I would check whether these people are someone I know or someone I loved. So this kind of feeling will always haunting me.
In May, Elema was co-author of a report from Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. It found that Chinese companies in the solar supply chain in Xinjiang are using workers from government labor programs. The Chinese government says these programs are about jobs and reducing poverty. But Elema says they're really part of a forced labor system, and that Uyghurs who refuse to take part can end up in internment camps or prison.
If they refused, or they're not actively participate in this program, they will be marketed as extremist, separatism, terrorist. Refuse is not an option.
Chinese officials have repeatedly denied allegations of human rights abuses in Xinjiang. Elema's co-author is human rights researcher Laura Murphy. She says the government system of control in Xinjiang is so vast, it could include up to 2 million people.
I think the system of forced labor that we see happening in northwestern China right now in the Uyghur region is unprecedented. It is organized and facilitated and subsidized and incentivized by the government.
Murphy and Elema's report focused on the solar industry because one key component of solar panels, called polysilicon, is made in Xinjiang.
These companies produce 45% of the world's polysilicon,
which is then shipped around the world as a key component of solar panels made elsewhere. Johannes Bernreuter in Germany is a global market researcher on polysilicon.
You could describe it as the heart of a solar panel.
At least 9 companies in the solar supply chain in Xinjiang were linked to forced labor in that UK report. But Bernreuter says that parts of all solar panels, even the ones made in the US, can be traced back to China.
Basically, all solar panels in the end are contaminated by forced labor in Xinjiang.
For this story, I contacted 5 of the largest companies in Xinjiang, and none of them responded. One of the biggest manufacturers in the region is a company called Hoshine. It's named in an order from the Biden administration issued last month that bans the imports of the company's silica products.
So this is a welcoming step. This is one of the most effective ways to handle the ongoing forced labor practices.
Nuri Turkel is vice chair at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. He was born in Xinjiang in a detention camp and moved to the U.S. in 1995.
It's been more than 20 years since I've been advocating human rights for the Uyghur people.
He says calling out big companies is a good way to put pressure on the Chinese government.
Two things are very important to the Chinese government. One is naming shaming, publicly calling them out for the ongoing atrocities in Uyghur homeland. And then two, going after the economic interests.
Activists have called for boycotts of cotton and other consumer items from Xinjiang. But Turkel says it's about time solar energy was added to the list.
Just focusing on cotton garments, textile products, are not enough. This has to be expanded to other areas.
Nearly 300 solar companies that operate in the U.S. signed a pledge opposing forced labor in the solar supply chain. Nuri Turkel says if the U.S. wants to work with China to promote renewable energy, it needs to be done in a way that upholds human rights.
We need to upgrade our infrastructure. We need to save the planet. At the same time, the Uyghur lives are as important as the environment that we're trying to protect.
China's foreign ministry responded to the Biden administration's import ban on solar products from Xinjiang. Here's a government spokesman speaking through a translator.
The U.S. uses human rights as a disguise to do all it could to cripple the industrial development in Xinjiang. What it does is detrimental to Xinjiang people's right to subsistence and development.
And he goes on to say that the real goal of the United States is to contain China. For the World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
COVAX, that is, as you may know, the global initiative that sends coronavirus vaccines to countries in need. In Africa, Ghana received the first shipment to the continent. So far, roughly 1 million Ghanaians have been vaccinated. The goal for the end of the year is to get that to 20 million people. As Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from Ghana's capital, Accra, history does not bode well for reaching that goal.
On the streets of Ghana's capital, Accra, many are hesitant to take a vaccine if offered one, like Abigail Kumsen, Eugene Lai, and Amina Fuseni.
No, I won't take the vaccine.
I am not convinced.
Because of the usage of the natural herbs and the natural remedy, I didn't see the need for me to take the vaccine.
I'm not sure I'll ever take this vaccine.
Media reports say some 2,000 vaccines deployed to northern Ghana expired due to low turnout. Foreign medicines, especially vaccines, have been met with suspicion and hostility in Ghana since the 19th century British colonial rule. And the suspicion still persists more than six decades after the country attained independence in 1957. Nana Esilfikundia is a political historian based in Accra. He reckons the resistance stems from a distrust going back to the time of polio.
There was great belief that the jab has side effects which are no good, making you maimed. That belief continued to exist.
It is not just the colonial history that is making people hesitant to take the COVID-19 shots. In 2015, Ghana agreed to join other countries in hosting trials to test the safety and effects of two experimental vaccines against Ebola. The virus had killed tens of thousands of people, mainly in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The pharmaceutical companies conducting the trials were Johnson & Johnson and GlaxoSmithKline. At the time, many Ghanaians complained they were being used as guinea pigs in a country that had not recorded any case of the deadly disease. Lawmakers took their constituents' complaints to Parliament.
If they want to do it in Ghana, they should do it in the laboratories with mice, rats and chimpanzees, but not with human beings. We would urge the Minister for Health and all those responsible for admitting or permitting this trial to take place here to reconsider. Not just to suspend it, but to say no, thank you.
The vaccines had been tested on monkeys before these human trials, which were supposed to occur in the town of Hohoi in the eastern part of Ghana. The people there are predominantly farmers. More than 90 miles drive from Accra, I arrive in Hohoi. I am here to understand how that whole episode in 2015 has heightened hesitancy towards COVID-19 vaccination. I meet 62-year-old David Ajakoku sitting in a blue plastic chair under a giant tree in his 2-acre compound house. He is a civil service retiree and part of those who led the street protest in 2015. He recalls his thinking at the time.
Why don't you try it on the whites? So Ebola, we feel they are just coming to run off Hohoi Township and then we die like fowls.
About 3 miles away at another compound house, 26-year-old Ishmael Isiawanam stirs kondo in an aluminium pot, preparing the day's supper. Ishmael was approached at the time to take part in the vaccine trials. He says volunteers were offered mobile phones and cash.
There was no record of Ebola here. Imagine coming just to tell me that you want to come and give me a medication of HIV/AIDS, whilst I know I don't have AIDS. That was what didn't convince us enough also.
In Accra, at the country's Noguchi Memorial Institute for Medical Research, immunologist Asamoah Kusi says the 2015 botched Ebola vaccine trial has been a major setback for the country.
When these COVID vaccines came up, I'm sure manufacturers approached certain countries to do trials. We were never approached by any pharmaceutical industry because of what happened then.
Even though mass COVID-19 vaccination is yet to be rolled out across the country, medical leaders are concerned about this history. To disabuse the country of some of these myths and misconceptions, President Akufo-Addo and his wife were the first in Ghana to take the jab live on national television.
Taking the vaccine will not alter your DNA. It will not embed a tracking device in your body. Neither will it cause infertility in women or in men. As your president, I want to assure you that the vaccine is safe.
To meet the end-of-year target of 20 million people, Ghana needs to administer about 65,000 doses daily. However, currently, there are no vaccines. Ghana's presidential advisor on health, Dr. Anthony Nsiasare, insists vaccination plans are still on course.
We will step up our vaccination and get the necessary vaccines to vaccinate the 20 million Ghanaians in the third and the fourth quarter of this year. And we can achieve the target. I'm very, very hopeful about that.
Earlier this year, the country's Food and Drugs Authority, the Ghana Health Service and its partners began campaigns using posters, billboards, social media and mainstream media to fight misinformation concerning the safety of vaccinations and conspiracy theories. But experts say realizing a safe level of vaccine acceptance will take some time. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
One of Ghana's cultural treasures is the country's traditional palm wine music, as it's called. The lyrics are often filled with morals or lessons. This mellow number from the legendary palm wine singer, songwriter, and guitarist Ko Nimo is a great example. The message, you will be overtaken by events, so always listen, listen, and listen again. And that'll do it for us this Tuesday, at least until tomorrow. If you can't wait that long, we're always online at theworld.org. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be healthy, stay safe. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Hey!